You're listening to the Wordslinger Podcast, episode 81, The Writing Life with Mark Lefebvre.
Writing a book. It can be the best way to build or grow your business, or to simply tell the story that you wish to tell. Learn how to write your book in 30 days or less. Pick up 30-day offer today from Amazon, Apple iBooks, or other online retailers.
It's the Word Slinger Podcast, where story matters. Build your brand, write your book, redefine who you are. It's all about the story here. What's yours? Now, here's the guy who invented pants optional, Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger.
Word Slinger.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger. Thank you for tuning in yet again. I really appreciate you being here. I am, right now, I'm kind of, I'm grooving a little. So it's really hot. It's really hot in the Houston, Texas area right now. I don't know what the actual temperature is, but I think it's probably somewhere in the billions of degrees. I'm comfortable, actually. I'm in a very well air-conditioned apartment, but every time I step outside, it's kind of like the life gets just sucked right out of me. It's wicked out by the Houston heat. So I don't know why I bring that up. It's just one of those things. It's like I'm kind of dragging a little, but I'm also kind of just chilling. I've decided, you know, this is going to be a good day to be in the apartment all day. So, now, speaking of the apartment, we got back. I think I talked about this last week, but I mean, we returned. Not this past weekend, but the weekend before, from a couple of weeks, just kind of gallivanting about the southern U.S., getting all the way up into Colorado, spending time in Garden of the Gods. It was amazing to be there. That experience has really, it's kind of set the dominoes a little, and I'm ready to knock them over. We're still planning to move into the RV full time in October of 2016. That's this October. I don't know when you're listening, so I throw a year in there. But you can judge me if you're in the distant future. You can judge me by whether or not I actually managed to do this. But no, we're definitely doing it. We have the RV now. We've spent a couple of weeks in it. We're kind of grooving to it. We like it. Now, whether that holds out long term, you know, that's still to be seen. But I'm pretty confident we're going to do okay with it. Anyway, we're coming up, depending on when you're listening to this, and I think you're going to be listening to this on a Friday in June, but we're kind of coming up on the 4th of July holiday here in the U.S. If you happen to be outside the U.S., that's Independence Day for the United States. It's a big day for us, full of barbecues, getting together with family and friends, and in our case, taking the RV down to a lake that I used to visit quite a bit when I was growing up. Camping out there for 3 or 4 days. Not a big trip, but it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. I know this is not RV talk or anything. I just, you know, I feel like I should update you guys on what I'm doing. This dream that we had to do this is getting closer all the time. And it's funny how the universe works. You know, God likes to bless you in ways that are kind of unexpected in the moment. And I'm a Christian. I'm going to confess that I'm very proud of my Christian background, my Christian faith. And, I am, happy that, you know, God is there blessing us with this stuff. I mean, as soon as we decided this is what we want to do, it's like the universe just sort of aligned to it. And there's still some big question marks, but every time we make a major decision like this, everything lines up to help us do it. So I'm pretty happy about that. So, in other news, if you are a fan of this show, I really appreciate your support. Now, there's a couple ways to do this. One of my favorites is if you go on iTunes and rate the show and give it a review. I'll remind you to do that again after the end of this interview, but that really helps. I'm not seeing as many reviews these days, and I think it's because I don't ask enough. So, my grandfather's quote still rings in my ears. I never got a thing I didn't ask for, even if it was a punch in the face. That means ask for what you want. And so I'm asking you guys, go out and support the show with your reviews, with your stars, by sharing it with friends. And I think it's really helpful. I was talking to Roland Denzel. Hi, Roland. I was talking to Roland a few days ago, and he told me that one of the things he appreciated about this show was the sort of the eclectic nature of it, like the idea that, you know, I'm not always talking to just like self-published authors or even people in that industry. I happen to be today, I'm talking to Mark Lefebvre, not Mark Lefebvre, as I, you know, pronounced it before, but Mark Lefebvre, the French pronunciation, not the dolt pronunciation. So I'm talking to Mark, and, you know, he works with Kobo. He does Kobo Writing Life, that program geared toward indie authors. Very helpful. It's just amazing what they're doing over there. I really love their work. I love the platform. But, you know, Roland was commenting that, you know, I like to bring on a sort of a group of people who aren't always tied to the same stuff over and over again, which I think is a benefit because I get a lot out of these conversations. I meet people who are in different walks of life, different types of businesses, have different stories to tell, and it just enriches my own experience, and I'm hoping that that's what I'm bringing to you. So if you're liking that, I would appreciate it if you would let me know in a Apple iTunes review. So thank you so much. Excuse me. I'm sorry to clear my throat in your ear like that. And you can also support this show financially, and that is also much appreciated. If you'll go to wordslingerpodcast.com, you can click on the Patreon button there and actually support the show with as little as a dollar per episode, a quarter per episode, I guess. I don't know how low you can go, but you know, every little penny I get will help tremendously. I greatly appreciate the help. I have not gotten my act together to create a sort of reward structure there, so I will get to it. I will get to it. I don't know when I will get to it, but I will get to it. So many things going on right now. You have no idea what goes on in the background of this show, of my writing career, but it's all doing well. Coelho Medallion, I've discovered I've been pronouncing it wrong, but Coelho Medallion has been doing very well. Still in the, kind of fluctuates in and out of the top 100 in its category. It did well in Amazon Total for quite a while there. But in other news, my good friend and writing partner Nick Thacker has released The Amazon Code, and I really want you to go pick this book up. It's a fantastic book. It's another Harvey Bennett story, which is one of his sort of his character that's a little like a Jack Reacher, or, you know, It's his main character, we'll say. It's for these series, and it does he does a fantastic job with this book. It hit number one in travel fiction, which I am envious of, and so it has hit bestseller status already. It's doing extremely well. You should go check it out. I'll put a link to it in the show notes so that you remember to do that. So Nick Thacker, The Amazon Code, definitely check that out. Okay, we're 8 minutes in. Sorry about that. Let's get to the interview, the stuff that you really tuned in for. And I hope you enjoy this interview with Mark Lefebvre. I love talking to Mark. I met him at the Smarter Artist Summit back in April of this year. And, you know, I wanted to hang out with him when we were in Ontario, but we didn't get a chance. But he's a great guy. He's got a big heart. He's got a head on his shoulders for helping the indie author community. He's really excited about helping indie authors. So if you happen to be an indie author, I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. So take care, enjoy, and I'll see you after the interview. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Now, I'm sitting here with someone that I'm actually really glad I got a chance to meet this guy at the Smarter Artist Summit back in April. Early April, and I would love to have spent some time with him when my wife and I were hanging out in Ontario, but it just didn't happen, so next time. But I'm actually talking with Mark Lefebvre, who is, among other things, let me read his bio. He can say it much better than I can. Mark Lefebvre is a writer, horror, nonfiction, paranormal and thrillers. He's an editor, he's a bookseller, and am I getting all this right? I think I'm flubbing it, Mark. I'm sorry.
Just call me a book nerd. And you got
you're
it all
a book covered. Nerd, and you're working with Kobo, which is exciting.
It's very exciting. Probably been the most exhilarating job of my bookish career.
Now, what's your official title there at Kobo?
Officially, troublemaker. No, officially, it's Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations, also known in some circles as Director of Kobo Writing Life, which is our DIY publishing platform, direct to Kobo.com.
That's why I had you read that instead of me, because I think I got about halfway through it. I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to let Mark say this. So thanks for being on the show, man. I appreciate it. you know, I love everything about Kobo. When I was in Canada, now this was a couple of months ago now, you guys are everywhere there. Every time I went into a bookstore, I saw you guys. So that's impressive to me. Now, I'm American, so that's why it's surprising to me, right? Because I never see anything Kobo. Like, no one's ever heard of it around where I am, unfortunately. And I still include Kobo as one of the links to where you can purchase my books on each book page.
You are a gentleman and a scholar, and you are a global author because of that.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons why I did that. You guys are very big elsewhere, other than just Canada. I mean, you've had pretty good penetration in, like, Europe and those areas, right?
Yeah, because Amazon was in the U.S. early, and then let me see. So you've got the world's best online store, the world's biggest online store and biggest bookseller. Mm-hmm. You've got the world's biggest sort of media company that owns the platform and the device, Apple.
Right.
And then you've got the world's best search engine, all kind of fighting for the U.S.
Right.
And so Kobo decided, all right, we're in the U.S. We're partnered with the American Booksellers Association, the Indies. So we're tapping into a different market than's already been taken over by the big guys.
Right.
And we focused instead on building our global expansion,
right,
expanding as widely and as quickly as possible into different territories. Obviously, as you said, Canada is where we were born. Our home office is in Toronto still, even though we are owned by Rakuten, which is a Japanese company, kind of like a gigantic company that owns other companies. we are the ebook. We are the digital ebook reading platform for the entirety of Rakuten. Instead of building something, they bought Kobo in order to be in that game, because they have, you know, various online retail channels. And so in Canada, people may actually use the word Kobo the way that people use the word Kindle in the States, right, to mean e-readers. And the way you use Kleenex for facial tissue,
right,
or something like that. So when you're actually on a subway or on a bus or in a public place in Canada, you're more likely to see a Kobo.
Yeah.
You may actually see Kindles, because Kindles are actually available in Canada, mm-hmm, but you rarely see a Nook. Those are kind of like a rare bird sighting.
Yeah.
And you see, of course, a bazillion iPads and iPhones and,
right, right, and
that. But yeah, so it is. It's something you go, oh wow, people have a sort of slightly different brand preference in this country.
It's really kind of interesting. Now, is it? Do you guys? Is the Kobo e-reader, is that sort of the main way that people read books from you guys, or do they use iPad? Or
it's 50-50 split between the electronic display devices and the apps. And initially, interestingly, when Kobo first launched, our mandate was you should be able to read any book on any device at any time,
right,
from anywhere.
Yeah,
that's what we wanted. So we started out, we developed apps for, you know, the world's hottest handheld device, the BlackBerry. So
right,
the BlackBerry,
right,
and then we did the iOS, and then we moved into Android as that grew. So we had free apps for those devices. We had free apps for Macs and PC, if you prefer, mm-hmm, on your computer. And it wasn't until we were around for about a year, year and a half, that our customers demanded that we make a dedicated e-reading device.
Hmm.
And right now, of the Kobo family, I'm wearing the Kobo Aura H2O shirt, which is the world's premier waterproof e-reading device, which we actually launched almost 2 years ago. We have the Kobo Glow HD, which, you know, built-in light, and then the Kobo Touch 2.0. And we had a bunch of devices as well. We even started creating tablets. Yeah. I still own Kobo Arc, you know, 10-inch. And I love it, and I use it more for graphic novels and stuff like that, because it's, you know, it's better than a smaller device.
Right.
But we realized it was fully Android certified on Google platform, and you could actually, ironically, you could buy a Kobo Arc and you could install the Kindle app and the Nook app and all the other apps on it.
That's cool.
It was Google, and it was a beautiful device, but we couldn't produce that device as cheaply as so many of the Android tablets that were out there.
Right.
So we decided our game isn't creating devices. Our game is content.
Right.
Our game is booksellers. Kobo's one of the original slogans was "Read More,"
right,
and our goal was to bring readers and writers together.
Yeah.
And and to make reading a part of your life. I think right now it's what is our new tagline that we just threw up on the website? Is that used to be read freely, but now it's open up.
Okay.
So it's very much about an open world, an open environment. It's very much about just being there for however you want to read your book.
Right. That kind of sounds like you guys are going to dip into different content markets besides just ebooks.
Well, I mean, it's no secret that Rakuten purchased Overdrive.
Okay. I had heard that, but I wasn't. To me, it wasn't confirmed. So
yeah.
That's
so I mean, okay. And Overdrive is about the library market, right? And Overdrive has academic and library market. We're in the retail market, and we have been working very close with Overdrive. So the CEO of Overdrive spends about a week a month in the office in Toronto. Oh, nice. One of our executives spends a week a month in the Cleveland office of Overdrive. And we are working very, very collaboratively. As a matter of fact, I mean, my focus with Overdrive and the good folks that I've been working with there is on securing the ability for Kobo Writing Life authors who are publishing direct to Kobo Writing Life to click a checkbox and push their titles directly into Overdrive. It does two great things. It's one last place you have to log into.
Yeah.
It means Overdrive doesn't have to manage the volume. It's difficult to deal one-on-one with a lot of people, right? And in Kobo Writing Life, we've built the ability to do that. But then it also allows our authors the ability to get extra sales and extra money from, again, a different segment, especially in the U.S. market, that they may not be in, or if they're in, because they might have gotten into the library market, they're not getting the curation. So they just dumped all the self-pub titles in one spot, and the librarians ran screaming in the other direction because they went, oh my God, there's too much noise. I don't know what to do. I'm just going to stick with the ones I know. Yeah. And so one of the great things we've been doing with the Overdrive team, and we've already started doing it, is we've been providing them sales reports showing them, here are the 1,000 top sellers in each of these categories.
Yeah.
And the other thing librarians have been interested about have been local authors. So we can say, all right, Houston Library, here are some authors that we know live within a two-hour radius of your library.
Yeah.
If you want to feature local authors who may not be traditionally published,
right,
here's their titles. And the other thing that we're really excited about sharing with them, and this is something that we've been open about sharing, is reading stats.
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, but maybe it didn't sell 5,000-10,000 units. Right. Maybe it only sold a couple hundred units.
Right.
But the conversion reading rate, more people finished this author's than that author's book. That's something librarians love because it shows everyone who picked it up loved it.
Yeah.
And so we're working.
Authors love too, by the way.
Oh,
I would love to know that too.
And that's something that for the tail end of 2016, the Kobo Writing Life team constantly has, they probably have at least 18 months of backlog work to do.
Right.
But that's one of the things we've been working with our big data team. Mm-hmm. We've been working with content analytics team in order to give authors that conversion. So, for example, you do a first free in series.
Mm-hmm.
You see, well, okay, our download thing is a little bit broken. So you're not actually seeing all the downloads just yet.
Okay.
The objects in the mirror are larger than they appear.
Oh, good.
You see 12,000 downloads,
right,
and you say, oh, wow, there's all these downloads. How come I only sold 300 books?
Right.
And the reason is when you actually break it down, you say, of the 12,000 people, and this is based on a number of stats that we've run. This is sort of an average. Less than 2,000 of those people actually open that book after 6 weeks.
Hmm.
And of them, maybe a quarter of them actually finished the book in 6 weeks.
Right.
But of the people who finished the book to conversion to sales, you're looking anywhere between 45 and 55% conversion.
Right.
So you can understand, all right, if I can get them to read my book, there's a 50-50 chance they're going to buy my book.
Right.
So that's cruel. And not cruel, it's critical.
Yeah.
What's cruel?
I was going to say cruel.
It's cruel is okay. Of the people who picked up the book and didn't get through, where did they stop? And if we can find a commonality, we can share that and say, you know what, chapter 7, you know that long exposition passage that your editor told you should really cut down? It was 10,000 words,
right,
and it could really be 2,000 words. You know how you didn't agree with your editor and you told him to take a hike? Maybe this is your evidence. And this is the great thing. Indie authors can do this.
Right.
No major publisher would do this, but
no.
Could say, you know, I'm going to go back to my editor's notes, and I'm just going to take chapter 7. I'm going to cut that down and see what happens. And we love the fact that we can give these stats and know that you'll actually use it to your advantage and our advantage, mm-hmm. because you'll sell more. And obviously, when you sell more, then we actually make money too.
Yeah. Okay. I love how empowering that is for authors. I mean, for the libraries is obviously, I mean, that's actually good for recommendations and culling through all that noise, as you pointed out. But for authors, man, that's gold, because one of the things we lack, really, especially on platforms like Amazon, we don't ever get any data on that stuff. So that's pretty awesome.
No, that's been our mandate from the beginning is to be as open as possible. Now, the one caveat we have, and this is, in all honesty, one of the reasons we haven't yet pushed out any detailed stats. Sometimes we've done experiments where we've taken an author and said, okay, we're going to look at this one series for you, and it's like an 8-week project, and we come back and we provide them some like reports and stuff like that. You need to have enough of a volume of reading of sales in order to report on it. Otherwise, we risk the chance of exposing the privacy of the reader.
Right.
And the privacy of our writers and the privacy of our readers is very, very important. So therefore, when I look at, let's say this is a perfect example. My mom hates the stuff that I write because I write horror and stuff like that.
Okay.
So, you know, let's say I'm all excited. I published my book and I have one sale. And now the other thing we provide is in the monthly sales reports that we email to our publishers and authors who publish through Cobalt Writing Life are basically publishers. Yeah. They get the same sheet that Random House gets. Random House probably has a few more lines in them because they have a lot of titles. But your titles that sold in the last month, it's an Excel spreadsheet, and it shows you ISBN line item, and then it shows you quantity, and if it's sold through a retailer, so if it's sold through Chapters Indigo, which is kind of like a Barnes & Noble here in Canada, a big chain that you probably saw our books in Barnes and in Chapters Indigo, or through an independent bookstore in the U.S., or wherever it's sold, Fnac in France, however, or from Cocoa.com, then you see, you know, what the cost of goods were in the currency, and then the conversion to U.S. dollars if you're in the U.S. Then you see the zip code or the postal code of the customer who bought it. And that's important because you may be doing media in-person things. When you're at a bookstore and you're signing books, you know how many you sold because you signed them.
Right.
But if you're at a bookstore and someone walks in and they see, and there's Kevin signing his books, blah, 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 and then they go home or they do the old, you know, the Kindle thing where they go and they buy it on their phone, right? You don't know that you don't know that being there actually helped you sell ebooks. So we show you the fact that being there helped you sell ebooks too.
Yeah, that's because amazing. You can see.
So the risk, let's go back to my mom. I sell one book in April and then, you know, second week of May, I get my finance spreadsheet and I see my mom's postal code because I know my mom's postal code and then I know I only sold one, and my mom goes, yeah, I bought your book. It was good. And then I look at my reading stats, and I go, wait a second. Mom, you never opened the book. Or you read the prologue, and you stopped. I mean, this could cause family issues, and we don't want to be responsible for mothers and sons not talking to one another.
Right.
So we need to, when we provide the reading data, we need to make sure that we can include there has to be enough volume to create privacy for our readers.
So what's the threshold for that?
And we're still trying to figure it out. So the threshold is I don't know. I mean, we're looking at different numbers. It's a comparative thing. It could be as low as 50 sales,
right?
You know, in order to anonymize, or 50 sales from different territories. But then again, if I have one sale in Canada and one sale in Saudi Arabia and one sale in South Africa and one sale in Australia.
But you're not saying, if you've got 50 sales and 45% of those people read the book entirely, you know, that's, you don't know exactly who did or didn't.
It means I can't stalk people and go make them read my book, right?
Right.
So I call mom every Saturday and say, so have you read my book yet? And actually, ironically, just to let you know, my mom, who does love me dearly, actually did read my books recently when there was a power outage, and she had nothing to do and she couldn't put on the TV, so she actually picked up the puck that I've given her over the years, and she's like, hey, you're not bad, you know?
Left with nothing else to do, she read her son's books.
She's very supportive. She's like, why don't you just write a nice romance novel, then I'll read it.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate in that my mom actually enjoys the kind of fiction that I like to write. So, and that's been a lot of fun, but it's also kind of a detriment because I'm not writing fast enough for her.
Well, that's a good thing.
That is good, yeah. She's a lot. In fact, she's in my demographic, my target demographic, so it works out fine. So that's something I don't, you know, I know that you're a part of Kobo, and we're talking about Kobo, but I want to make sure I talk about your work too, because, I mean, you're an author, and that's important because you're part of the very audience you're trying to reach from your work, right? So, I mean, what are some of the titles you've got? I know you've got a new one coming out, or you've had one just come out, right? It's coming out in May.
Yeah. What is it called? Creepy Capital.
Creepy Capital. I was going to read it if you didn't.
Creepy Capital, Ghost Tales of Ottawa and the National Capital Region. Ottawa is the capital city of Canada. It's our Washington. And it is the city. I lived there for 10 years, and it's the city where I discovered the thrill and magic of going on a ghost walk. If you've never gone on a ghost walk, what a great way to experience a town or a city. What a great way to realize that history isn't boring.
Right.
What a great way to learn more about the people and the culture and the, and you know, all the people who lived here hundreds of years before you. And so I mean, I had a blast working on this book. I went back to Ottawa. I spent a lot of time there, went on the tours, went to the locations, really was able to immerse myself in Ottawa. And then again, at the end of May, I'm going back for the official book launches. I'm excited because I met the Ontario Ghostbusters, and they're actual fans who create and replicate the Ghostbuster costumes and the paraphernalia. And they do, it's for, they work for charity. So you give them a donation and they come to a special event. So I'm thinking, I don't know why I never thought of this, but I was at Ad Astra, which is a sci-fi con last week. And I'm looking at the woman who's the president of Ontario Ghostbusters and said, oh my God, I write ghost nonfiction ghost books. Why don't I have Ghostbusters come with the new movie coming out? That will be a thing. People will be going, oh, cool. That's neat.
Right.
And even if they're not interested in the book, they may come over to see the Ghostbusters and then go, oh, ghost stories. Cool.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited because I need to get them book them in for the end of May. But
that's very cool.
So I do. And those are traditionally published books with Dundurn. But I actually self-published my first book.
Okay.
Back in 2004, 10 years before all the cool kids were doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And back when it was probably the worst thing you could do for your writing career. it was actually a good thing for me because it was the launch of my getting my name and my brand out there. And I'm really excited that I was on the forefront of self-publishing back in the early days where, I mean, this is even before ebooks.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Did it help or hinder? I mean, how did it do?
Oh, it helped dramatically because I set it up through Ingram Lightning Source, and now there's a new version of that called Spark, which is like the Fisher Price version.
Right.
It doesn't give you as many options, but it's easier for people.
Yeah, I think we're both having allergies or something, so we're periodically pausing our mics to cough.
That's so hilarious.
It's a warts and all show, man. I don't let anything slide.
Well, at least we have the cough button.
Yes, exactly. Most people who come on don't actually have that, and I love mine. So, okay, so you self-published your first book, but you're traditionally published for the rest of your books. Was that before or after you?
No, actually, it's a mix. It's a 50-50.
It's a mix, okay.
So, I mean, I did One Hand Screaming, and it was an interesting thing because I had sold a bunch of short stories, horror, science fiction, speculative fiction, to a whole bunch of different markets. This was, you know, zines, you know, 500 circulation or whatever, and I would get my money, and then they'd be gone. They'd be out of circulation after a month or a quarter or something.
Right.
And so people would say, so you're a writer? And I go, yeah, I'm a writer. And they go, oh, great, where can I get your books? And I'm like, well, I don't have any books. And so so I looked at it and went, if I take all these previously published stories and I put them in a collection, I can make it available through Lightning Source, which makes it available on Chapters Indigo, our big retail, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all the major retailers as print on demand. Any bookstore in the world can order it because Ingram is the world's largest book wholesaler.
Right.
And because I've been a bookseller for, you know, 20 years, I knew I had to make full discount give the biggest discount I could to the bookstores and make it returnable.
Yeah.
Because bookstores won't order a POD book if it's not returnable. They don't have anything against POD. They have something against returns.
Okay.
Right? So it's an investment. They bring it in. They hope to make money. If it doesn't, it's like a tenant in a building. If it's not paying its rent,
right?
Okay, you're out and the next guy's in because I need to pay the bills here.
Right.
Because it's kind of a low margin business for bookstores.
Right.
Among other retailers, right? The highest discount a bookstore will ever get is probably 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, in other retail, your discounts are ridiculously high. That's why you can go into a clothing store and you can get a store that shirt that's 150% off, and then you get an additional 5% off, and then you get,
right.
And you realize that, like, you know, they're selling it for $80, but the cost was $2 or $5 or whatever.
Right.
So I made it available, returnable. I was able to call up a Barnes & Noble when I was traveling through the States a couple months in advance and say, "Hi, I'm an author. I'm going to be in town these days. I'd love to come in, do a book signing at lunchtime or whenever, you know, whatever, you know, traffic for you." And they would do it. And they'd bring in like 5 copies. And then, you know, I'd sell some and then they'd return them when I was gone. And I was able to build up a brand. And so that was done. I've self-published a few other books. And then I also traditionally published. I traditionally publish my nonfiction mostly.
Okay.
So one of the reasons I still like to work with a publisher, it's been a good experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't make as much money. You know, a $25 book sells and I get $2 for it.
Right, right.
But I don't pay for the editor and I get great editors. I don't pay for the cover design. I don't have to worry about distribution. Yeah. So in bookstores.
So your personal overhead is very low.
Yeah.
And yeah.
The best thing ever is when Costco picks it up.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a book signing at Costco a couple years ago.
Really?
And it was amazing. I went to do my launch for Spooky Sudbury. Sudbury's a town in northern Ontario that's a mining community. And I was doing the launch at Chapters, and then I was doing another book signing at Kohl's, which is like a mall store.
Right.
Like
we have Kohl's.
Classics or whatever you used to have as mall stores then that were parts of a chain. And then the promotions manager at Dundurn said, "Oh, Costco got your book in. They want you to come by and do a signing." And I went, as a snobby book guy, I went, "Costco. No one buys books at Costco. All right. I'll swing by on my way out of town," because
right.
It's a 6-hour drive to get home from Sudbury.
Right.
"On my way out of town, I'll swing by and I'll sign some books Sunday morning." And I get to Costco on Sunday morning, and Costco doesn't open until like 11 a.m. on Sundays in this town. And there's a lineup at the door, and I'm coming in with Barnaby. I have a life-size skeleton because I write horror. That's one of my props I use.
Okay.
So I got Barnaby with this Spooky Sudbury shirt on, and my buddy's with me to help, and he's got some of my props because I have skulls and stuff that I put on the table just to either draw or scare people away. And there's a big sign at the front door with my author photo, like, blown up in the cover. "Today, Mark Leslie, author of Spooky Sudbury." And as I'm standing there thinking, okay, these are the people coming in to get their cookies and their big giant bags or whatever. And I have a few people going, "Oh my God, it's him. It's him."
Wow. Half the
people in line were there to see me. And
at
so
Costco. I never even imagined Costco.
I go in and the staff were honestly way nicer than any of the bookstore staff in Sudbury were to me.
Yeah.
Well, except Kohl's, they've always been gracious and so amazing. But like the managers and the cashiers were like, "Oh my God, I'm on cash. Can you sign a book and have someone run it up to me? I would really want to buy it." And they were just so excited. I mean, they had only had 2 other authors in their store before. They had Anne Murray, who's a Canadian singer you probably have heard of, and Gordie Howe, a hockey player.
Yeah.
So it was like, wow, I'm in pretty good company. So I get there. They have a huge table across the skids. There's, you know, the section where they actually have books.
Yeah.
There's one of Stephen King's books. I think it was Dr. Sleep.
Okay.
And then there was a Uncle John's Bathroom Reader. I don't know if you have those in the States.
Yeah.
And then it was Sudbury. And so I took a picture. I'm like, "Oh my God, look at me. I'm hanging out with King." Uh-huh. And then I stayed 6 hours that day because I could not leave the table. I couldn't even go for lunch. There was always people buying books all day. I sold half a skid of books.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done book signings for years and years where you're lucky if you sell 5 books, right?
Right, right.
You know, don't look the writer in the eyes, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
This was the greatest experience I've ever had signing books.
That's unbelievable.
I outsold Stephen King.
Wow.
I can say that. I took a picture of the skids at the beginning of the day, at the end of the day. Now, of course, it was one store, one afternoon in one city.
Oh, you did
But, and he never even noticed.
Right.
Admittedly, had he been there and I'd been there, I wouldn't have sold a single book and he would have sold everything. And once his skid sold out, then people went, oh, there's another guy here.
That's why they don't put two authors together at book signings. I never in a million years would have thought that Costco did. I've had Costco memberships. I've been there. I buy books from Costco, but I never would have thought that they did author signings. So now that's something to look into.
Well, now when I'm going to Ottawa and the publicity manager has set me up with a bunch of book signings. I said, I'll swing by Costco if they want. And there's three Costcos in Ottawa that'll have my book as well. Wow. But I guess it depends on the staff. So I think because I've been in book selling for a long, long time, some people say, oh, you go to the chain stores, they don't care about your book. It really depends on the staff.
Yeah.
The staff are the heartblood of a bookstore. Mm-hmm. If the manager, if the staff members are open to local authors, they're probably going to be more supportive than you would ever imagine. And the same thing. So at this Costco, they must be book nerds.
Yeah.
They're into it and they're supportive. And so you can get that from an independent bookstore and say, well, I'm not going to, I don't like your sci-fi stuff.
Right.
And then you get another independent bookseller that's like, oh no, man, there's a staff member who just loves the genre stuff and is pushing it like crazy. So there's no, I hate to do any blanket statements because every single bookstore you walk into is a unique and vibrant part of that community. Mm-hmm. And they have a demographic that they serve.
Right.
If my horror books don't serve their demographic, then it's not going to be a good relationship.
Right.
There's no point in me getting angry with them if they only sell literature.
Right.
It's not my thing.
Right.
So I think that's one thing that authors can benefit from understanding is that it's the same thing. If you know your market, you say you know your mom's part of your demographic.
Right.
So what bookstores would she shop at? And then that could be that there could be some synergies there.
She's in that demographic, and this is my writing partner Nick Thacker. We've done some co-authoring together, and we're on another podcast together. But we have this weird quirk. Like we think our measure of making it in this business would be to walk into like a grocery store chain or Walmart or something like that and see our books. Or drugstores, and see our books on the shelves. Right. And it's silly. It sounds silly to some people, but like I could almost care less about getting in Barnes & Noble or any other chain bookstore. If I could get in those shelves, that's where my readers typically like to pick up their books. So,
or the airport bookstore.
Or the airport, right. The airport is fiendishly hard to get into, though. From the research I've done, like that's, you got to be pretty high up. You got to start.
Exactly. Because they only carry just the best sellers, right?
Exactly,
but again, the grocery stores and the drug, the Walgreens and stuff like that, those racks are pretty limited, right? They only have 30, 40 titles, and they're typically the mass market names.
Right.
And mass market is still owned by traditional publishing.
Yeah, right. Kobo gets in there.
Well, I mean, you could be standing in line at the grocery store and buy any
book
you want.
That's true. That's why I think you'll start seeing things like, and I want to see this happen. If I'm standing in line at the grocery store and instead of a physical book there's a barcode for me to buy that book, right?
Yeah, you know what? There's a company in Calgary here in Canada. I can't remember their name. Enthrill is the name of the company. They created them. There's these beautiful little cards that are a little bit bigger than like this is a Tim Hortons gift card, a little bit bigger. It's got the cover of the book on it.
Yeah.
And then you go and you can download it in any format: EPUB, MOMI, whatever, PDF, whatever.
Right.
And they're at the checkout counters of some stores in Canada and the U.S. and they've been around for 5 years. And the cool thing is, I can buy a card, I can buy the new James Patterson or whatever, publishers to make them available to them, put it in a card, mail that to someone anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
They can download, if they've already read that book, the cool thing is they scratch off and they type in the code. If they've already read that book, they can use the dollar value to get a different book.
Different book, Oh, that's awesome.
And I love Enthrill, and I was an independent bookseller when they first started. And I was, I mean, I moved to Kobo before it happened, but they were actually starting to distribute where they had like a little rack of books that you could actually have a card. Because again, I was at a campus bookstore. We were selling iPads. We actually had Sony readers. Yeah. Kindle wasn't available in Canada yet. Right. And Kobo, I don't think there was a Kobo reader yet.
Yeah.
When I was there. And so it was a really interesting thing where I thought, this is what I want. And I think it's still early days.
Yeah.
It's stuff like that's going to happen. You're going to walk in and be able to get it whatever format you want.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful thing about it. It feels like to someone like yourself who's been in the industry and has been doing some stuff and at the forefront of right. what's going on with indie authors, you forget that, 60 to 80% of Americans have never read an ebook.
Right.
Right? They don't even
that's
know what
shocking.
Right? So think right. about when people think, it's, the Kindle Gold Rush days are over and it was nothing like it was in 2011. Are you kidding me? We're at the very beginning of the global transformation of the book industry.
That's a very good point.
Our original CEO, Mike Cerbenis, used to say, Kobo is at the very forefront of a 25-year transformation of our industry.
Yeah.
And our goal is to be, the best reading platform available. That Kobo stands for the reader, and we're all about the experience of reading books. That's it. We don't sell anything else. That's our forefront. And again, it's still early days. I mean, it's only 2016.
Right.
What's it going to be like? I mean, you saw Joe's Joanna Penn's presentation.
I know.
Right?
That was amazing.
Like, thinking 2020. She's mm-hmm. thinking, what are those next things? Like India, where you can buy a smartphone for $5.
Right.
Let's talk about a market where you're not going to have a dedicated e-reading device. You are going to be reading on a cell phone.
Yeah. Because the mobile market has opened up huge, especially in like underdeveloped areas. Africa, for example, there are hundreds of countries where mobile phone technology has sort of jumped the gap, because there was that moment where there was no technology, and then a trickle of like desktop machines, and then suddenly mobile phones that could do everything a laptop could do. So
way more than your first computer could ever do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you've got those programs out there like one laptop per child and that sort of thing that we really a lot of us saw that and thought, that's going to change the world. But I really think that the smartphone is what's going to do it. Smartphones and tablets, because they're so cheap to make, they're so cheap to distribute. And, as a writer, I can't wait to find more readers who are on those things.
What a great segue into something that I think is great advice for writers, and that is a lot of writers, the biggest mistake that they make is they only think about the U.S. market.
Yeah.
And maybe they think about the U.K. because mm-hmm. those are the two biggest markets in English language to get into ebooks.
Right.
But again, tip of the iceberg.
Right.
And that's why, in Kobo Writing Life, we have the ability to control 8 currencies. It's going to be 17. Wow. It's actually taken us already a month overdue from when we were supposed to launch it, only because we have such a dedicated UX user experience team that they've done some dramatic improvements, because the way that the format looks for 8 books and the way that it needs to look for 17 can be overwhelming and pretty scary.
Right.
And so we've done multiple iterations and improvements to it. But then that will allow you put in your U.S. price, but then you put in a unique and specific Canadian price, because it's a different customer.
Right.
It's a different experience. And in India, you can put in obviously the lowest price possible.
Right.
And so we're really eager to help authors find success global, because we see such tremendous and amazing growth,
right,
even with English language titles,
mm-hmm.
In so many countries that you wouldn't expect you're going to sell books in. And that for me is one of the most thrilling aspects of getting to do this, getting to work in right. this industry.
I'll tell you something that I think would be very helpful, and you guys are probably already working on this because you're leading edge in this stuff, but one of the problems that I personally have, and a lot of authors I know have this, is determining what the actual right price should be for those markets. Because you get auto-suggested prices, for example, from KDP and from other sources. Sorry about the vibration. That's my phone going off. But the problem is that those always auto suggest, like, you know, $2.95 for a Canadian book that, you know, and what's the right price? And for India in particular, like, everyone says go for the lowest price, and I want to do that. I don't understand their currency though. So what would be nice is here's a system that contains maybe some average prices for books that are selling and suggest prices based on that, because that way, you know, we can automate that and it's a push of the button for us as authors. But
yeah,
I don't know if that's anything that's in the works with you guys or whatever, consider it a plea.
So it's something, it's something whenever we do a presentation to authors, we are very clear. We show the market. Yeah. Here's the market in Canada for thrillers.
Yeah.
Here's all the books that are selling. Here's a and we actually break it down to Cobra Writing Life and then all other publishers.
Right.
So you can actually see, hey, this is where the average book is, and it's actually volume we're sharing. Here are the price points that are selling in this genre in this country, and they change. So you can't just have a single pricing model. The Cobra Writing Life blog, CobraWritingLife.com, we have published some articles on that. We're going to get more detailed. I've actually solicited help from both the merchandisers. Our merchandisers are in 16 different countries.
Right.
Actually, in those countries, merchandising to those customers, right, to the different demographics. Getting advice from them on the optimum price points for different genres in that country, because it is different. Getting there's a gentleman who runs the My Kit Lab podcast who I was on his show recently, and he's from India. He's going to write a special article from his perspective as an author in India on what prices work best in India.
Yeah.
And again, so the best way we can share this in a large manner is on the Cobra Writing Life blog. The UX team is also trying to build in some price optimization, but the challenge is that our reporting systems and the database systems aren't connected. So getting accurate, up-to-date, you know, like what I tell you, April 2016 may be different in May 2017.
Right.
So the one of the only ways we can do that is manually. Right. Getting the price optimization. Like I've played with the tools in Kindle Direct Publishing, right? Again, as you mentioned, I'm an author, so I use all the platforms. I'm familiar with them.
Right,
I know what competition is doing because I'm an author there too. And it's funny because it's kind of like it feels like there's some algorithm in the KDP price match that just tells everyone to price all their books at $2.95 or $2.99.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like
no matter what it is. Just,
It's like one of those. It's one of those. It reminds me of the Simpsons cartoon where Duff, Duff Light, and Duff Extra were, you know, three separate vats, but they were all coming from the same pipe.
Yeah.
Split up.
Right. Right. Anytime we can work in a Simpsons reference, that's going to be good news.
It's just going to be.
Pricing is one of those funny things. My rule of thumb lately, I'll be honest, and I'm cheating, but what I do is when I'm pricing for a market, I go into that market's bookstores and I look digitally. I don't want anyone to think I'm flying to these places, but I go into those stores and look at whatever Joanna Penn is pricing, and then I do what she does.
You know what? That's really, really smart. I mean, that is the thing to do, right? And that's a great one. Go to that market. But I look at the top sellers. I look at the top 10, top 20 books in that category.
Yeah.
And the ever look at is, and if you have a print book, it's easy. But imagine this was a print book. What would the price be?
Right.
So and you can look at print books and do the same thing. I usually start with 50% off the print price, then go look at what the top sellers are and adjust your price up or down.
Okay.
It's just like this weird sort of, I wish I could come up with a formula for, you know, hardcover or paperback price divided by 50% plus or minus, depending on the number you get from the average price. And again, and if it doesn't work, price is a verb. It's not a noun.
Right.
Think of it as flexible. And if it's not working for you, hey, you have the ability to change it because you didn't preprint your price on the book.
That's right.
Right? I mean, benefits of indie authors.
Yeah, one of many. All right, so we're kind of coming up on time, and I appreciate. I know you got to get back to work and everything, so I'm going to let you go. But I've got lots of websites from you, especially the Kobo Writing Life blog. So we'll send people there; they'll find that in the show notes. Anything you want to just pitch? And, you know, I know you have Creepy Capital. That one just came out, or is it coming out?
It's hitting bookstores in the next week or two. Okay. It's going to be at the end of May. It's on pre-order on all the main sites in ebook and print format.
Okay.
It's specifically about Ottawa, so it's not all that interesting to people outside of Ottawa.
Interesting. You never know. Yeah.
Tomes of Terror was my last one, which is haunted bookstores and libraries around the world. So it's all universal. And if I can get my act together, my editor gave me back some amazing notes. Yeah. A Canadian Werewolf in New York. And I have to get the damn book out. It's one that I've been working on for a while. The edit notes are just amazing. He's helping me make this a much better book, but I actually haven't had the time to work on it because, well, you know, 60 and 80 hour work weeks.
Exactly. Man, you got to start making more money from your books, man. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up then. Thanks, Mark, for joining us. Everyone else, you're probably hearing some nifty music right about now. We'll see you after the interview. Mark, thanks so much, man. I'm glad we had a chance to talk. All right. Take care. Isn't it weird how I always manage to predict that there's going to be music right there? It's just weird. So that was my interview with Mark Lefebvre. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Mark is a great guy. If I'm connected to him on Facebook, I follow his adventures, and he's quirky and crazy, man. He's my kind of crazy too. Recently he posted a whole bunch of photos of him like blatantly ignoring warning signs in like a national park or something, you know, and it was just very funny. So, and he's just, he's kind of in, a, you know, when you meet him in person, he can look a little intimidating. And sorry, Mark, I mean, it's true, but you kind of have that rugged, you know, I don't know, you look a little rugged. And then when you get to know you, when you talk to you, instantly, you know, you're a hell of a nice guy and someone you want to know and hang out with, so have some drinks with. A lot of fun. It was a lot of fun meeting him at the Smarter Artist Summit. I'm glad we got that opportunity. I wish I'd been able to. There were a couple of other events he went to that I was almost part of, but did not get to go. And that's a shame because now we've got kind of a camaraderie. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Now, just closing out, I appreciate you tuning in. Some things I just wanted to say, and I don't like to get political or anything with this podcast, and I know I can be kind of a loud mouth on Facebook. I've been curbing that, by the way. You know, the recent shooting in Orlando, I just feel like I should say something to this. It's a horrific tragedy, and I don't want to end on a downer. What I want to end on is something positive, and I will. But first, let me say that I pray for the victims of the shooter, the families of those victims, and as hollow as prayers sometimes feel to people who don't believe, this is a commitment from me, just speaking on the behalf of those victims. It's tragic. It's horrible. And I wish evil like this did not exist, you know, but it does. And if there's anything that can come out of it, it's that we can have a greater awareness of who we are as a people. I like what Mr. Rogers said. Mr. Rogers, when he was a child, he said that as a child, he would watch the news and he'd become very upset because he would see, you know, these tragic things, these horrible things happening in the news. And his mother told him, when you see something tragic, look for the helpers. And he did that for the rest of his life because there were always those good and kind people who are there to pick up after a tragedy, who are there to comfort the victims, to provide, counseling, to provide, you know, support in any way that the victims need. And there were so many people who came out and did that after this tragedy. there's a lot of hatred that gets spewed on Facebook and elsewhere that I wish didn't happen. A lot of infighting, excuse me, a lot of, it was very upsetting, I'm sorry. A lot of people using this tragedy to further their own agendas, politically and otherwise. But I think that the reality here is that there are good people out there. We sometimes hate each other for the stupidest reasons. And I wish that weren't so. I really do. But we're better than that. We are. I believe in you, and I believe in us as a species. I believe that we can do some actual good in the world, and that we can love each other. And so I hope that that ends up being the lesson that's learned from this tragedy. I hope that that ends up being what our hearts and souls take away from it. So look for the helpers, everyone, and be a helper if you can. So that said, and like I said, I didn't want to end on a downer. I just needed to say it somewhere where I think I will be heard. but all that said, you're good people. You really are. I don't know each and every one of you personally. I know a lot of you personally. Some of you I've been in contact with, you know, on social media and email, in person at times. And I've yet to meet anyone who listens to this podcast. And that's several thousand people at this point. I've yet to meet anyone who isn't a good soul. And so I thank you and I thank God for you. I pray for blessings in your life. And I hope that whatever you get out of this show, I hope it renews you and refreshes you every day. Or every week. Maybe every day, depending on when you're listening. So God bless you. Take care of yourselves out there. Be safe. Be a helper. Thank you for being a part of my life. And I'll see you next week.
Wordslinger.